Musings on Golf gets into the geometry and physics of our game this week, and we offer short stories on recent events involving a PGA Tour player and a former PGA of America official. Indeed, school is starting to let out for the summer in parts of the country, but school is definitely in session as we welcome Bobby Clampett as our special guest in this episode. I am Professor Kelly Elbin, here along with the Dean, Jenna Self, our executive producer. And, you know, I think we have a really interesting show for you with Bobby as the centerpiece. Bobby Clampett, you knew that voice for, gosh, coming up on, 30 years on CBS Sports at the Masters in the broadcast booth. He had an incredible career at Brigham Young University, a three-time first-team All-American. He only won once on the PGA Tour, and Bobby talks, he's very candid about why he felt he only won once. And ultimately, it's all led to Impact Zone Golf, which is the culmination, as you'll hear, of his career as an instructor and all that's led to who Bobby Clampett is as an instructor. I will tell you, he is very much a disciple of the book, The Golfing Machine, which was published in 1969 by Homer Kelly. It's a complex book. It was very influential. It broke down the golf swing using physics and geometry. It was revolutionary scientific approach, computer age approach. It aimed really to help any golfer find their perfect swing by doing what? Understanding the mechanics, very technical nature. And Bobby was one of those who grasped that as a young man and continues to carry that method throughout his teaching career. It should come as no surprise that Bryson DeChambeau is another big-time disciple of The Golfing Machine by Homer Kelly. And Bobby will tell you who Homer Kelly was, and he'll tell you why this book was so influential for him. And I will say this, as someone who is a feel player, that's just my nature. I'm much more of a feel golfer. I think I would struggle immensely with going through a very technical book. For people like Bobby, a real cerebral guy, it was right up his alley, if you will. He adopted it early on. And Impact Zone Golf, the impact-based teaching, which is at the core of the schools that he has, both on the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States, and really more and more online, is what makes Bobby Clampett a central figure in instruction right now, well beyond his playing days and well beyond his broadcast days. Okay, two other things I mentioned about short stories. The first has to do with the PGA of America announcing late Friday in what I consider, you know, you hear these things about a news dump. A lot of times it happens in politics late on a Friday, certainly when it comes to a long weekend, which this was with Memorial Day weekend. Big news will be put out there to sort of maybe get it lost in the shuffle. And that's exactly what I think the PGA of America was trying to do. It's not a good look by any chance in announcing that Don Rae, who was really had been muzzled after the 2025 Ryder Cup, when he really kind of lost his sense of leadership and said some things coming out of that, and comparing the really bad behavior of a lot of people at the Ryder Cup to, you know, little more than what you might hear at a youth soccer game, said it at the trophy presentation that the Europeans had retained the Ryder Cup when in fact they had won it, was shown doing a karaoke get together Saturday night after the second day of the Ryder Cup when the U.S. was really kind of being embarrassed. But the board of directors of the PGA, instead of just saying Don Rae was fired or whatever, they used a soft term. They said it was a leadership transition on that Friday, and that he had been suspended and has been suspended for the remainder of his two-year term as president of the PGA of America. And that term ends in November. PGA of America Vice President Nathan Carnes has been named the acting president, and he is in line, and he'll become the next president of the PGA of America in November. I will say Nathan impressed me at the presentation ceremony in awarding the Wanamaker Trophy to Aaron Rye at Aronimink after Aaron played so beautifully down the stretch to win his first major championship. I will say this, Again, I made note. And the PGA of America has a CEO, a new CEO in Terry Clark, formerly the chief marketing officer at United Health Group. Terry's relatively new to the position. Terry Clark needs to be the face of the PGA of America when it comes to its major events, such as PGA Championship and the Ryder Cup, just as he was, quite honestly, on Wednesday at the PGA Championship in sort of the state of the PGA. And Nathan Karns and all of the Eric Eshelman, who's been elevated to the acting vice president as well as secretary, they need to focus on member initiatives. And Don Rae is not a bad guy, but Don Rae got in over his skis. Don Rae, he wasn't ready for the moment. And when you put a volunteer person in that position, and that's what PGA of America officers are, they're volunteers. I know it all too well. My father was president of the PGA in the late 60s. They have jobs. They are volunteering their time. They're good at what they do, but it doesn't always mean that the president in a volunteer position is going to be able to handle big-time questions about big-time activities at massive events such as the Ryder Cup. It cost Derek Sprague, a good man, his job as the CEO of the PGA of America, and it has now cost Don Rae his job as the president of the PGA of America. I wish Don Rae well, and I hope the PGA figures out where it's going, because there's a lot at stake for that 31,000 golf professional association with so many good people who care about that game and live it each and every day. The second short story, and I hope that was short enough, by the way, has to do with Wyndham Clark. Yeah, Wyndham Clark, like a lot of the players, quite honestly, had a feast at the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson, over the weekend, finishing at 30 under par to win that PGA Tour event. By the way, anytime you see, for me at least, to have 30 under par winning a tournament with Byron Nelson's name on it is a little bit tough for me to stomach. Nonetheless, congratulations to Wyndham Clark. He also mentioned that he has a new app coming out that he's developing to work on his mental game and some other things. And I wish him well, but I will tell you this. After the final round of the U.S. Open last year at Oakmont Country Club in one of the great locker rooms in the country, Wyndham Clark just ripped up his locker, tore it up in anger over the way he had played. And to me, as I posted on my Facebook page yesterday, this should have been, oh my God, I am so sorry. What do I need to do? I lost my mind. How do I make this up? And instead, as I can tell you, a very highly placed source who knew exactly what was going on informed me that it took Clark, quote, according to this individual, that Clark did the least in the slowest amount of time, end quote, to say he was sorry and to pay for the damages. He's already been barred from Oakmont Country Club, as he should be. And this also came 1 month after Wyndham Clark, in a fit of anger at the PGA Championship, fired a club after a poor drive, and he almost took out a volunteer. And ironically enough, the club smacked into a T-Mobile sign, and that's one of Wyndham Clark's sponsors. So I hope that Wyndham Clark gets it together. I hope he's got it together. He certainly seems like it as a golfer. Man, he seems like a very, very tough guy to root for. A guy to root for is Bobby Clampett. You'll enjoy this interview very much. Certainly encourage all of you to download, listen to, subscribe to Musings on Golf on Apple Podcast and Spotify. And this is one of those that I think you can come back to time and again and glean a lot of great information that can help your game, having listened to Bobby Clampett. You'll hear that interview right after you hear from our corporate partners, our good friends at William & Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. Our special guest today found success on the course and in the booth, and for the past 18 years, he has helped golfers immensely improve their games both in person and online through his impact-based teaching. Indeed, curly locks are still intact, as is the passion for the game he has known virtually his entire life. What a pleasure to welcome Bobby Clampett to Musings on Golf. Mr. Clampett, how are you?
Doing great, Kelly. Nice to be on your show.
Bobby, we're going to talk a lot about golf, but before we get to that, you own I got to talk about the ranch that you own out in Northern California. You're enjoying a little bit of homemade honey, literally, before we came on with your breakfast.
Well, you see, right? I still have my breakfast here, and yeah. So we bought this place 2 years ago, and it's the ultimate performance center for my students to come and train. Yeah. We have a full 18-hole par 3 course now that officially by the Northern California Golf Association recently got rated and is the most difficult par 3 course in the world. It's all artificial turf except for the surrounds around the green or grass, but the green itself is artificial. But yeah, so we have six hives for honey. And last summer, we produced our first ever honey. And so I'm enjoying that. It's super healthy for you. And it's honey is an amazing thing. Bees are just an amazing creature that God put on this planet. I'm just fascinated by them.
And ClampettRanch.com is where you can learn all about that, correct?
That's where we have things about our facility. And my wife is a certified coach in equine coaching. So wow. She uses horses and the horses that we have on the ranch to help people have breakthroughs. It can be leadership training. All kinds of things come up. But horses have a way of giving an amazing feedback that really brings a deeper depth into this coaching that she does.
And your wife, I know, is also very much involved with Impact Zone Golf, and we'll get to that certainly in just a second. In doing my research and looking at your career and your life, it's been a most fascinating one in golf. And you grew up in Monterey, California. Bobby, I really can't think of anybody, honestly, who won a PGA Tour event, had a lengthy time as a commentator. I can think of those two, but really having come full circle with what you've done as an instructor, you operate in multiple schools on both coasts of the country. It strikes me, and I would imagine you've lived it. It has been a very interesting life in golf for you, has it not?
I love the game of golf. And Kelly, it's a passion for me because even long before I developed impact-based teaching, I was fascinated by how there was no standard of teaching in the game and how you could go to so many different coaches and get so many different opinions. And everything seemed, as I now term it, style-based. So they would have a particular swing that they wanted to move you into, right?
Right.
Like a stack and tilt or a one plane or an A swing or any number of these C-factor swings, whatever it might be, or X-factor swings. So these swings were all style-based, but the best players in the game have such a variety of styles of swings, right? And you look at Jim Furyk won over $100 million now playing golf. Look at that golf swing, or what Bryson does with his swing, and he's changed it again, and he's always changing it. And Tiger's won majors with different golf swings. And all these coaches are teaching a particular style. Well, the common denominator, what all these great players do, isn't their style. It's not how their position of their left wrist is at the top of the backswing, whether it's cupped or whether it's arched or flat. It's not how much hip turn they have, or how much shoulder turn they have, or whether they're an upright swinger, or they're shut-faced at the top, or open-faced, or they line up a little left, or they line up a little right, or they release early, they release late, they have this kind of finish, that kind of finish. No, that has nothing to do with what makes a great player. What makes a great player is their ability to create great impact. And the impact of all the best players of the game is virtually the same. Yeah. So I had this aha moment when I was working at CBS. I worked at CBS Sports for 29 years as a golf commentator. And they developed something called the BizHub Swing Vision Camera, which everybody's pretty familiar with, right?
Yeah, sure.
And I was fascinated, Kelly, with this technology. And I would go up there to Moxie, Mike, and John in the booth, and we would pull up these videos, tapes that they had recorded during the day of all these players. And I'm watching, you know, all these different swings, you know, cross the line at the top, laid off at the top, shut open, all these different stuff. And then I'm studying what they do at impact. And then I started measuring what they do at impact and started identifying what are the measurements that we can actually measure at impact. And they're all virtually the same. And that's where I developed the whole concept of low point, which is now kind of standard in the industry, but it was the impact zone that came out in 2007, where I introduced the whole concept and value of where the low point should be in the swing, and saw that for every inch that your low point is behind where the pros have it, which is 4 inches in front of the ball, for every inch, the average golfer loses 4 strokes on their handicap. And so this became a eye-opening thing for me. It's like, why? Why has nobody ever even talked about low point? This is like groundbreaking stuff. And it's just one of the elements of impact that we need to study, but it's a very important one too. And how it relates to path and how it relates to face angles and consistency of face angles and where we're hitting the ball on the face. The purpose of the golf swing is not to look good. The purpose of the golf swing is to hit good golf shots. And you look at, I remember years ago as a kid, I was reading an article in Golf Digest by Dick Altman, and it was featuring Lee Trevino. And the title of the article, Kelly, 7 Wrongs Make a Miraculous Right. You can't make this stuff up, right? Yeah. They couldn't explain why Lee Trevino was one of the best ball strikers in the history of the game. The only thing he lacked was distance. He could hit it so straight. He could shape the ball so well. He was an amazing ball striker, and he had incredible impact. And this is what dawned on me, is this is the way to teach the game, not to teach the game by positions, because everybody does it differently. And so I developed a whole system of how to improve people's impact. And it's not, and they can keep their style of swing and improve their impact. And it applies to putting, and it applies to chipping, even though the impacts are different.
Yeah, how does it apply to putting? Give me an example.
Okay. Well, putting, for example, you want to have ideal roll. Nobody talks about what ideal roll is on a golf ball. Okay.
Yeah.
And so we've done a lot of tests and discovered that ideal roll depends on the speed of the greens, but usually you want to launch the ball between 2 and 3.5 degrees of launch angle with topspin. That gets the ball enough loft on it or launch where it can get up on top of the grass but roll so it doesn't bounce. I see too many amateur golfers when they're putting, their ball's bouncing across the green. You can't control that. And most amateur golfers put backspin on the ball. They don't even know you're supposed to put topspin on it. And how do you put topspin? Well, you have to have an effective angle of ascent of the putter greater than the effective loft of the putter. That's the equation for putting topspin on a putt. And most amateur golfers don't even know that. And so how are they going to be able to control line and speed well if they can't even put a good roll on the ball?
Yeah.
So that's an example. And we know that putter face is so much more important in putting than path, so that angles of the putter face determine line much more than the path does. So things like that and impact. And it doesn't matter whether you're a long putter or a short putter, or you have a saw grip, a claw grip, a reverse overlap grip, cross-handed grip. It doesn't matter. What matters is, are you able to create good impact on a putt? Because then all you have to do is get the right speed and read the green right, and you're going to make everything.
How long did it take you with Impact Zone Golf, which you've written a book about it. How long did it take you for a large group of people, a large group of golfers to start to flock to you or at least get buy-off that, okay, Bobby, I understand what you're trying to say. I'm interested. I want to pursue this.
So, Kelly, I'll tell you, this is a true story. So I got asked, I was broadcasting full-time at CBS, and then my wife and I said, I've still got a bug to go play. So when I turned 50, I went back and played the Champions Tour. And I played for 5 years. I played 88 events on the Champions Tour. And fortunately made more money on the Champions Tour than I did on the regular tour in 15 years. Yeah. So I had already written the Impact Zone. And I was getting so many calls and emails from PGA professionals, coaches, avid golfers, after they read the Impact Zone, going like, this is crazy. Then I get a call from the PGA and they said, Bobby, do you know, we interview the top 100 coaches every year and before they get selected. And did you know that your book now was named number one most influential book in their teaching by over a third of the top 100 coaches? And this is back in 2008, right after the book came out.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I didn't know that. So then they said, we would like to invite you to be a guest presenter at the National Teaching and Coaching Summit. So I'm playing the Champions Tour and full time. I'm not even teaching, but I go and I do a presentation about impact. And then they had breakouts into six different breakout sessions where the six keynote presenters broke out into their own area on a driving range in Orlando. And of the 500 attendees, about 480 came to me. And my wife and I looked at each other and went, something's up with this. We better keep going. Yeah. So we've continued, and we now have certification that we're developing, a new certification we're developing for instructors, almost done with the first level of it, which is also available, by the way, for the average golfer. It's called the Master Class. And you can go, and there's six different master classes. Graduates of the master class get what we call a player certificate from Impact Zone Golf. And it's also a prerequisite for certification later for the teaching professionals.
Oh, that's terrific. You have schools, I understand, on both sides of the United States. Is that correct? And you also have online learning. Is that right?
Yes. So we're based in Naples, Florida. And I have three full-time coaches working for me there in an indoor studio in Naples. We do. We have some great technology with Swing Catalyst. I serve as advisory for both Swing Catalyst and Foresight Sports. And we have some great technology there. We also have a Sam Putt lab there. And I'm building, I have the same, pretty much the same here in California, in addition to having my 18-hole par 3 course. So I'm the only one that teaches here in California, but I also teach in Naples. So, and I have my team that also teaches in Naples. And then we do an increasing number of online lessons. I'm doing online lessons almost daily now with my students because they can't come see me all the time. And how do you keep students progressing on what you're working on if they're only going to come see you every couple months? No, you got to have consistency with your lessons and your practice. And that's the great formula for improvement.
Bobby, tell me a little bit about the book, The Golfing Machine, which was written by Homer Kelly. I know you growing up as a kid in Northern California, in Monterey, that was a book that, from my research, sounded like that's
here.
What...
I'll grab one off my bookshelf. Hold on.
Yeah, please. Never Too Far Away, right?
Is it, you mean this one?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
Why did that guide you? Why was that the sort of the guiding golfing Bible for you as a kid?
So Lee Martin was my first coach, and Lee left Quail Lodge when I was 13 years old, and I was an 8 handicap. Lee had really brought me along nicely, and he took a teaching job in Florida. He's still teaching, and now is loves Impact Zone, and has gone through all my certifications, so he loves it. But Ben Doyle came to Quail and became the director of instruction at Quail Lodge in Carmel, California. Ben came from the Pacific Northwest, where he met a Boeing engineer by the name of Homer Kelly, who had just written The Golfing Machine and was starting certifying instructors in The Golfing Machine. And Ben became the first authorized instructor of The Golfing Machine and spent a lot of time with Homer. So by the time he got down to Carmel, he was very well read on The Golfing Machine, extremely well read. He probably knew it better than Homer himself. And so Ben and I developed a friendship, a relationship, and became my coach. And I learned so much from Ben, and learned a lot about the engineering mind of Homer Kelly, but more importantly, how it applies to golf and the laws of physics that surround the game of golf. And if you really get down to it, many people call Impact Zone a golfing machine for dummies, because it's taking the essence of what is in The Golfing Machine, which is an extremely complicated book of breaking the golf swing down into 24 components and 15 variations of each component, and over a trillion different combinations of golf swings, which are styles, right? It breaks that down into five simple dynamics of how to create the best impact, like the best players of the game. So that is the essence of how the Impact Zone got developed, because it's a much easier to comprehend and gets into what really matters rather than what's available. And what's available and looking at styles has really confused people, because there's authorized instructors of The Golfing Machine and they all teach differently. Where the beauty of impact-based teaching and impact-based instructors is they all teach impact from impact backwards. So they're all teaching very similarly and not confusing students, but simply taking what students can do already and improving that by improving their impact.
Hey, Bobby, this has been a fascinating conversation so far as we learn all about Impact Zone Golf. Tell you what, make a short break to hear from our friends at William and Harry Golf. Then we'll come back for the rest of our exciting interview here on Musings on Golf. At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry Golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William and Harry, style with a mission. Bobby Clampett joining us here on Musings on Golf. Bobby, you strike me as a very cerebral type of individual, and I would imagine at that age to really dive into a book like that was not the norm for a lot of young players. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, when I got into things like the game of golf, I got into it, right?
Yeah.
I was, at the age of 13, I was playing every single day. Unless I was sick, I was playing and practicing every spare moment I had. And so I went into it full line, hook, and sinker. And Ben was right there with me to help me break through it. And so, Ben really taught me the physics of the game and the essence of the game. I taught myself how to score. And by playing and competing, Lee Martin always told me, play a lot of tournaments, get out there and practice and play. And so that was really the combination that was a good winning combination for me to in my success.
Bobby, a little bit off the golf course. Can you talk about your dad, please, and the relationship that he had, the things that he did as a pilot, as a flyer, and even to the point of the relationship with Howard Hughes Aircraft. It's fascinating.
Well, yeah, my father was in a different generation. A lot of people thought he was my grandfather, but so he was almost he was 65 when I was born, right? So so when you go back to his history, he was deeply into aviation, and he was a two-time national air race champion in the pylon division, which is one of the scariest, dangerous endeavors anybody can do. About 50% of those pilots die, so it's just crazy what he did and survived. He later became Howard Hughes' chief test pilot, and he would test one of the planes that actually went down in the Mojave Desert, and he was stuck in the desert for 3 weeks before they found him. So he was quite the aviation enthusiast, right? He was also, I hear, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm hearing that as chief engineer of the San Francisco Flying Club, they invented retractable gear in aircraft.
Wow.
Which was fascinating. So I've been a pilot for 39 years myself now. I've got 6,500 hours. That's how I flew the tour. That's how I flew all my work at CBS Sports.
Did you fly from event to event?
Oh, yeah. All the time. So, I've flown hundreds of times across the country now in my little Malibu. And just this week we're heading to San Francisco Bay Area tomorrow. We're going to Denver on Saturday. So, still flying a lot and love it. It's been a big part of my life.
Hey, I have to ask you, why did a California kid choose to play collegiately at a Mormon school at BYU?
I get asked that a lot, Kelly, and it doesn't seem quite right. Well, the bottom line is, so I graduated a year early from high school. I went to Robert Louis Stevenson High School in Pebble Beach, a great high school, by the way, and learned so much. College was actually easy for me compared to high school. And I was fortunate enough to be able to graduate high school in 3 years. So I graduated a year early. I was barely 17 when I finished high school. And I had, fortunately, was player of the year in Northern California in the juniors when I was 16. And set the all-time point record, and then I broke my all-time point record in when I was 17. So I was recruited by a lot of schools, as you can imagine, but not that many, only about six schools. And it came down to Stanford and Brigham Young. And so I had a lot of the faculty at Robert Louis Stevenson, my high school, that were Stanford alumni, and a lot of members at Quail Lodge that were Stanford alumni. So everybody was pushing me to go to Stanford. So I go up to Stanford on my recruit trip, and they had just fired Bud Finger as the longtime head coach there. So John Brody was the interim coach, and so John took me on my recruit trip, and we had a great time together. I loved John. And he took me around. And honestly, I had a couple incidences with some of the students where I just felt like they were very distant, hard to talk to. And when I went to BYU and had a great time with Coach Tucker and a great recruit visit, and he took me up to Sundance, and we had dinner in the tree room with Robert Redford and his daughter, and I'm seeing all these gorgeous-looking Mormon girls at BYU, and all these great facilities. And, oh, by the way, Robert's going to give you a free season pass to go to Sundance, and you can ski all you want, because I'm a very avid snow skier and still am.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I talked to some of the students. They were really friendly and easy to talk to. And I thought, this just feels like the environment I want to be in.
Yeah.
And then Stanford was really in a flux. They hadn't announced their new coach. They weren't they weren't really responding to my emails. And I later found out they had overpromised a scholarship to me that they couldn't produce. And that was the cause of the lack of communication. They didn't face up to it. So I ended up going to Brigham Young. It was a great choice for me. Coach Tucker and I got along great. The team and I got along great. And I played there for 3 years. And when I was 19, I graduated college.
Three-time first-team All-American. What, you won the Fred Haskins Award as the top collegiate player twice. I was really interested in the fact that you were the low amateur at both the U.S. Open at 78 at Cherry Hills and then at 79 at the Masters. You were actually, Bobby, what, the youngest player in the field at 18 in 78 when you were the low am. Were there any, it sounds like there were any nerves. I mean, you're just a kid going out there and playing unbelievable.
Oh, there
golf
were nerves,
the
all right.
Stages. Were there?
Oh, my gosh. So when I was 18 and qualified for my first U.S. Open, I'd never played a pro tournament before. So this was my first experience, and I get paired with Fuzzy Zoeller in the first two rounds. And Fuzzy kept me loose and free out there. And I was playing really well. In fact, after 24 holes, I was the sole leader of the U.S. Open, which was crazy. And I was so unprepared for that because I just didn't know what was coming. And, you know, to go into that press room afterwards and deal with what I dealt with as a barely 18-year-old. And then the next day I get paired with Lee Trevino in the next to last group. And I walk up to the first tee and there's literally 30,000 fans on the first hole alone. It's 10 deep everywhere. I've never seen a scene. Even to this day, I've never seen a scene quite like that. Yeah. And it was so intimidating. I know it was intimidating for Lee, too. He completely topped his one iron off the first tee. Didn't even get airborne. Yeah, never seen anything like it. A tee shot, completely topped.
Yeah.
And then I whiffed it twice from just off the green. When I went right under the ball out of the deep rough twice, and we both double bogeyed the first hole. And he said to me, God almighty, man, can we start over?
Sounds like him. Sounds just like him, right?
So, yeah, that and then the Masters, I got to play the Masters, was super stoked to play the Masters. And here's a funny story. So I'm playing with Sam Snead in the second round, right? I'm 18 and Sam is 68. And we played three holes. Had a rain delay, called me up into the player dining. We spent 4 hours together, called us back out on the golf course. We played, got to the 15th hole. It was dark. I said, Sam, are we supposed to play? And he says, keep on playing, son. We got to 16, could barely see the green. We hit. I still couldn't believe nobody was coming to get us. Finally, we go to 17, could barely see the silhouette of Ike's tree. Second shot, I had to walk all the way up to the green to see where the flag was. And we ended up finishing the 17th hole. It was completely dark. Finally, they came out and said, it's too dark to play golf. And I go up to the leaderboard. You wouldn't believe this, Kelly. I go up to the scoreboard. I have to par 18 to make the cut in my first Masters. I can't sleep a wink. You think I was calm, nerve? No. I think I got 3 hours sleep that night. I was a mess. And I rolled, how am I going to play 18? And I figured out three wood, six iron, two putts. That's the way I'm going to play it. As I'm on the range, that's all I'm hitting, three woods and six irons. As I walk to the tee, it dawns on me. I hit three wood twice in practice rounds and bogeyed the hole. And I thought, now what do? I turned to my caddy, asked him. He says, I don't know. And I pulled a driver out. I hit a perfect fade, a little driver up the gut, eight iron, 12 feet, and made it for birdie. To make my first cut in the Masters and ended up finishing in the top 24, which back then requalified you for the Masters. So I'm still to this day the youngest to ever requalify for the Masters based on performance.
Great story. Do you remember what those 4 hours were with Sam? Did he share stories with you, or it had to be pretty neat?
It was just the two of us. And it was special for sure.
I don't always want to bring up bad news on this show, but sometimes we have to. Do you look back, 1982, you have a five-shot lead midway through the Open Championship at Royal Troon. Do you look back at what happened, particularly on the decision to you know, be aggressive out of the bunker and it cost you, and you ended up, what, finishing tied for 10th? That was your first Open Championship appearance. You're five up at the midpoint. I think you were seven shots ahead with 31 holes to go. Bobby, what happened?
Well, that one shot on the sixth hole in the third round where I was in one of those pot bunkers and tried to hit sandwich out was the wrong play. So that's inexperience there. The shot would have been a blast with an eight iron where I could have advanced the ball about 50, 60 yards and then would have been able to get home in three with the three wood on the par five and still had a chance to make par. Instead, I was trying to catch a sandwich perfectly and it didn't carry the lip twice in a row. And then I was forced to blast out and ended up with a triple bogey. So that was inexperience that Mark O'Meara and John Cook and I later figured out what the right play was. And we kind of went through that together as my buddies. But, you know, I was struggling with consistency a lot. For example, I shot 65 playing with Johnny Miller, Billy Casper, and Gary Player in a practice round on Tuesday that week. And then the next day, I'm playing with Billy and Johnny and shot 75. And I went back to the range and I'm working on the range. And I was a hard worker. And I finally got it about 10 o'clock at night. I finally got it figured out and then went out and played, you know, shot 67, 66 the first 2 days and set the open record at Troon for that. And so that was, but it was also great short game. Yeah. And when I lost it, I started losing my swing a little bit in the wind. Of course, played a lot more difficult the last 2 days. So precision was even more important. And so and I ended up losing the Open Championship by 4 strokes. So to Tom Watson. And going through that, I realized that I need to get my game to the next level. And I got talked into going to see, right after that, the so-called best coaches of the game.
Yeah.
And I went to 4 different ones. And the common factor that they all said is I need to completely change my golf swing. But they all said 4 very different things about how I needed to change my golf swing. And so the following year, I decided to devote my time to working with one coach and completely change my golf swing. And I never cracked the top 80 ever again when I was, you know, top 14th and 17th my first 2 years on the tour. But that's what I realized, that golf is not a game of style. And the way the teachers and coaches were going about trying to help me, and they were well-meaning, but the difference was they were trying to go about it by changing my style of swing that wasn't my swing. And if I'd known what I know now, I wish I could have been my coach back then for myself.
Sure, sure.
I would have clearly kept my style of swing that I had and worked on my impact. And I realized there were things in my impact that were off. My path was a little out to in. I was a little steep. And there were ways that I could have fixed that without having to redo my whole golf swing. And sadly, I didn't know about that, but I do now. And I'm glad to be able to help other kids and hopefully prevent them from ever going through the same thing.
Bobby, you mentioned about all the years with CBS Sports. How did that broadcasting opportunity come to be? And were you good at it? Did you feel comfortable behind the mic? Did Mr. Cherkinian mentor you? How did that work?
It's all great questions, Kelly. So I had no intention to be a golf broadcaster, right? I was playing the tour. The year was 1991, and I was having work done in my house. My contractor said, Bobby, I need you out of the house for 5 weeks. So I was playing regularly on the tour. So I played 2 weeks. Then it was the PGA Championship. Then I was going to play the next 2 weeks. I was in 4 of the 5, but I wasn't in the PGA Championship. So I called my agent, Andy Pierce, with IMG at the time, and I said, Andy, find me something to do during the week of the PGA because I can't go home. He says, calls me back. He says, got good news and bad news. And I said, what's the good news? So there's a broadcasting position open with TNT. They're the new team on the block that are going to be covering the cable coverage for the PGA. Yep. I said, what's the bad news? He says, there's 34 other guys that want the job. I said, well, hell, I'm in Raleigh, TNT's in Atlanta. Why don't you set up an interview? So he set up an interview with Don McGuire, the head of TNT Sports at the time. I fly down in my little private airplane at Peachtree to cab. Kelly, it was one of the five worst weather days of the year in Atlanta. I come in dodging all these level 3, 4, and 5 thunderstorms. Don McGuire picks me up at the plane with an umbrella, and he's just shaking his head like, anybody who was willing to fly in that kind of weather to get here for an interview practically gave me the job right on the spot.
Yeah.
So after the second day, I didn't think things went very well. I was very frustrated. The equipment wasn't working. Frank Cherkinian calls me into his office after the telecast. The day before, he had called somebody else in and absolutely blasted them. They came out crying. I thought, oh boy, this is going to happen to me. He says, Clampett, sit down. I said, yes, sir, Mr. Cherkinian. You know, we call him the Ayatollah, right?
Yeah.
He goes, I recognize talent. Yeah, I'm sure you do, sir. You know, I'm just sinking lower and lower into my seat. He goes, and you, kid, you've got talent. What are you doing this weekend? I'm like, well, I've got my obligations with TNT to do the cable coverage. He goes, no, I mean after that. I said, nothing, sir. I want you to work for me. I said, doing what, sir? I honestly thought, I was going to be like a runner or something. And he goes, no, I want you on the air. I go, in what position, sir? What you're doing right now as a roving reporter. I said, well, with all respect, sir, you don't have roving reporters at CBS Sports. He says, by God, I invented the position. We just haven't found the right person. You're the one. So he put me on the air, 91 PGA championship to follow John Daly, right? Ninth alternate. Yeah. And John and I were friends. We had played quite a bit on the tour together. And I get caught in the middle of that squeaky Medlin holding the pin on the 11th green where the pin was, he had touched the green as he was tending the flag, which apparently could be a 2-stroke penalty. And John's got a 3-stroke lead. And I'm hearing all the things and seeing the tapes and so forth. And John has no idea this, right? He finishes the 54th hole.
Yeah.
And I go up to him and I said, I turn my mic off and I go, you want me to brief you on what's going on? He goes, yeah, because they're whisking him to the, so he brings me in the car and he and I sit in the back seat. And I said, here's the deal. They're claiming that Squeaky put the pin on the green and that inadvertently was showing you the line. It's a 2-stroke penalty. I said, the putt breaks the opposite direction. So I know you never intentionally had Squeaky do that, and he wasn't showing you the line. It was just an accident. Just say the putt broke the opposite direction, you'll be fine. So that's exactly what he did. And Frank comes to me right outside the rules booth for a live update. I've never done a live update in front of anybody, nonetheless 300 million viewers in probably golf's most interesting moment of the year. And so I did my first on-camera live update with this camera right in my nose like this, you know, in front of 300 million people, and somehow got through it okay and just shared that I didn't think it was going to be a penalty, and it wasn't, so made me look okay. And that's how I got started at CBS. Frank started hiring me to do more right after that.
Fascinating year that year. That was the first year that CBS Sports got the contract with the PGA of America for the PGA Championship. ABC Sports had it for years. Daly being, what, the ninth alternate. And Squeaky Medlin had been Nick Price's caddy. But because Sue Price was pregnant, he went away and didn't play in the championship at Belrive. At Crooked Stick. And the rest truly was history. That had to be – what a starting event for you as far as a major championship, right?
Oh, it's crazy. I'll never forget. I'm walking down the 14th fairway on Sunday with John, and he's got a 5-shot lead. And he turns to me and he goes, Bobby, what am I supposed to do now? It was one of the funniest comments, you know. He was genuine. I said, John, just play for the crowd. Hit good shots and just play for the crowd.
Yeah.
And I think that relaxed him, and he started to really enjoy that moment. And then you saw him, you know, whooping it up with the crowd and getting into it. So it was great.
We are winding down our time with the great Bobby Clampett here on Musings on Golf. I'm interested, Bobby, as an instructor and someone who's very passionate on the teaching side, what do you enjoy about teaching the game that's different, if it is at all, from the joy you get from playing the game well?
It's very different. It's a very different joy. I've always had something in me. I love to help people. And I've been reluctant to be a teacher in the game for my whole career, but realized as I got older and as I retired from playing that is how I want to spend the rest of my life, is helping people play better golf. And I know to the very core of my being that what I've developed with impact-based teaching is the answer to better teaching. And when you see some of the figures of 4 million golfers quitting golf every year, when you see that there are 10 million wannabe golfers in the United States right now that don't know where to turn to get started playing golf. Golf is a hard game, but it's not an enigma and a mystery like most people think it is. Most people try to help their games by, and now we have a lower percentage even taking lessons because there is no training really by anybody to become a golf instructor, right? Yeah, it's very different. There's a lot of differing opinions out there.
Yeah,
and the system I've created is really easy for any instructor to encapsulate, because the reason that there's so much confusion is because there's confusion in style. If you want to sit there and have a debate over this wrist position versus this wrist position versus this wrist position, or laid off versus cross the line, it all should be revolved around impact. And everybody wants to talk about the biomechanics and the right position and what is the right position? What is the right swing? What is the best swing? There is no right swing and best swing. There is a right impact and there is a best impact. And that's what the purpose of the swing is. So helping golfers understand that. And sadly, as I've seen, I've given thousands of lessons now, right? And I've seen thousands of people play, and I've played thousands of pro-ams. Almost every golfer out there is a victim of style-based teaching. Almost everyone. They're going through every little junky place they can find on the internet, the golf magazines, Golf Channel, asking their friends, taking a lesson from a pro who's never been trained to be a golf instructor, and trying to find answers to their game. And it ends up, so many of them, and I've seen this over and over again, they get so frustrated with their game because they're getting so many conflicting and confusing ideas. They don't know where to turn. And so this is the whole idea behind impact-based teaching, is it nails the hammer on the head of the nail, where if you improve your impact, you improve your game. That's simple. So let's do that, and it creates a system of how you can prioritize what to work on first. There's always a way to get better at golf. But you have to focus on the purpose of the golf swing is to create good impact, not to look good. And sadly, you go to anywhere in golf instruction, they're style-based. And even if they say they're not and they're not trained by me, they're still style-based, I promise you. And it just doesn't work very well. It's not very effective. And it's sadly pushing more and more people away from the game when we want them to be brought into the game.
Javi, two final questions. As we record this, it's Monday, May 18th, the day after Aaron Rye played a remarkable final 10 holes at Aronimink Golf Club to capture his first major championship, playing those 10 holes in 6 under par. What did you see from Aaron Rye from an impact standpoint, or just at least from a, as you and I talked before we came on, of you used the word supernatural. He almost put himself in a spot, Bobby, where it was totally focused. But did you see anything also from an impact standpoint in what he did and what he does on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at impact perspective, you got all these guys have great impact, right? That's why they're there playing in there on the leaderboard in the final round of a major championship. So
right.
That's something they all share in common. What Aaron Rye did was on a supernatural level yesterday. And what I witnessed, and I've had this conversation often with my good friend Michael Murphy, who wrote Golf in the Kingdom. Michael's 96 years old now. Can't believe it. We host a golf tournament with Michael together in San Francisco. It'll be in the Tuesday of the Pure Championship this coming September. Anybody's interested in playing, just get up with Impact Zone Golf and we'll get you the right information. But Michael and I have had so many conversations about what does it take to get in the zone? Clearly, Aaron Rye was in the zone yesterday. You could see it. There was a calmness about him. There was a freedom. The game was easy for him. The putts were going in. The swing was right in the groove. All he had to do was stand over it and let it go and not get in his own way. And he got into that zone where he could be that free. And that's the place that all golfers desire to get to. I've had a few experiences. I'll share this briefly with you. Yeah. Where when I was on the Champions Tour, I met Michael Murphy in 2011, my second year on the Champions Tour. Within 6 months after meeting Michael and talking about this, I was in Minneapolis in the final round on the Champions Tour, hitting my second shot to the 11th hole with a 9-iron. Now, you wouldn't think much of it. Greens were soft. Pin was in a go-to position, had 133 yards. And I hit this 9-iron, and I turned to my caddy, and I said, "Go in." That's the exact shot I was trying to hit. Go in. Damn if the ball didn't fly right in the center of the cup and stay. And they caught it on the Golf Channel.
Yeah.
And 6 months, or within a few months later, I'm in Savannah playing in the Legends of Golf at Savannah Harbor Golf and Resort. And I'm playing amazing day, second round. Andy North was my partner, and playing with my good friends Bernhard Langer and Tom Lehman. And I'm having the round of my life. I'm in the zone. I've had 9 birdies in the first 17 holes. Bernhard's had 8. We're just like having a ball. And Bernhard was highly responsible for me going back out on the Champions Tour. We've been very close friends for a long, long time. And I get up on the 18th hole. Cameras are rolling. We're right there on the leaderboard, first page of the leaderboard. And I was supposed to be broadcasting that week, but I had asked my producer to take off so I could play, which I did, because I was more committed to playing than I was broadcasting, for sure. But I have this unusual shot, 191 yards, and I'm between a 5-iron and a 4-hybrid. And a 5-iron's not going to fly me on top of the ridge unless I just nutted it, and I didn't want to come up short. So I decided to hit this high cut with a 4-hybrid. And I hit this high cut, and it just comes in right at the flag, and all of a sudden you hear, boom, and you hear it hit the flag. And there's all this raucous upheaval on the green, like, what just happened? The ball flew in the cup again.
Jeez.
And they caught it again on national television. Twice. Yeah. I'd never done that ever before in my life. And I did it twice in a 6-month period right after meeting Michael Murphy and having these kinds of really metaphysical discussions about the zone and what it takes. That was Aaron Rye yesterday, where he just saw it, felt it, and it was easy. It just happened. He didn't get in his own way.
Even his reaction when he knocked in that 68-foot putt on 17, he wasn't jumping around. He was like, yep, I knew it's in. I made it. Yep.
Yeah. It's what I was trying to do. Okay, here we go. Next hole. And I'll try and do the same thing on the next hole.
Bobby, final question, and one that I always enjoy asking our guests. If you could play a sort of a magical, mystical round of golf with 3 other people, kind of rounding out a dream foursome, whether they were living, whether they're still with us, Bobby, or they passed on, who would those 3 be? Who would you want to spend 4 hours, 4.5 hours with, and where would you go play?
Wow. Tough question to ask, because there are a lot of close friends that I've had on tour. I was a huge admirer of Ben Hogan. Mark O'Meara invited me to meet him my second year on tour. We spent 3.5 hours in his office together. That was amazing. I was close with of course Jack Arnold. I was close to Johnny Miller. I'm still close to Billy Casper. I was close to some of the real greats of the game. And so I don't know how to quite answer that. I've been privileged. You know, I've had matches, one-on-one matches with Seve. I've gone head-to-head with Greg Norman. You know, I've played with a lot of the greats. I had the privilege of playing with Sam Snead in the Masters.
Yeah.
I'm so blessed, right? I've had such an incredible opportunity golf has given me to do the things I've done. So it wouldn't just be one foursome. I could come up with about 10 foursomes that they would all be super meaningful.
Let's tweak it another way. Are there three individuals who you never met, whether it was a Bobby Jones, whether it was a Walter Hagen, three individuals who preceded you into the game who you would have, gosh, I'd love to have spent a round of golf with them?
Yeah. Well, clearly Bobby Jones, I would like to. Francis, we met, you know, because Eddie Lowry was his caddy and Eddie grew up here in Pebble Beach. So that would be fun for me.
Yeah.
Walter Hagen, I was a big fan of too. So those are three names that just kind of pop up that I never had a chance to meet and would have liked to.
And where'd you go play?
Cypress Point. Where else?
Yeah. What is it about Cypress Point? What is the aura, the magic about that place, Bobby?
It's the most beautiful golf course in the world. I don't think anybody would ever argue that. The majesticness of all the cypress trees and the sand dunes, it's just incredible. I get lost out there playing Cypress. I just love the environment, the atmosphere. It's the walk in the park. I always walk it, so it's golf, as Michael Murphy says, is a game that's meant to be walked. So it's just a fantastic time to be able to spend at Cypress Point. And, of course, it's in my backyard, so I'm a little biased, too.
Bobby, this has been a pleasure. Please tell our listeners where they can learn more, where they can go to find out more about Impact Zone Golf.
Well, clearly impactzonegolf.com is the key website. That's the easiest thing. That gets you, you can get links there to our masterclass, which I encourage all our readers. They really want to improve their impact and understand what proper impact is and how to do it. Go through my masterclass. This is the culmination of my last 50 years of this game put into one program.
Wow.
And it is the most comprehensive educational program ever developed, and soon I'll have a book to go along with it.
Bobby Clampett, this has been an absolute thrill. Thank you so much for joining us on Musings on Golf.
Enjoyed it, Kelly. Thank you. Great job.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that really interesting interview with a fascinating subject in Bobby Clampett. Next week, we welcome in Fred Funk, who won 8 times on the PGA Tour, with by far his biggest victory coming at the 2005 Players' Championship, when Fred became the oldest winner of that event at 48 years and 247 days. For the Dean, Jenna Self, Kelly Elbin, the professor, this episode of Musings on Golf has come to an end. School is out. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to Musings on Golf.